I call the Senate Arctic Affairs Committee to order. Today is February 12th, 2026, and the time is 3:32 p.m. We are here with the Arctic Affairs Committee, committee members present, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Wilikowski, Vice Chair Senator Stevens, and myself, Senator Giesel. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you, Julie and Kayla, for helping us with the audio and keeping the records. So today we're having a presentation from the Institute of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Extension from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We had a presentation last year. It was so good, so we're pretty excited to have Jody Anderson back, who is the director of the Institute. So welcome, Jody, Ms. Anderson, Director Anderson.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Jody Anderson. I'm with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm the director of the Institute of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Extension. I live in Palmer, Alaska, as a full-time resident. I really appreciate the invitation, Chair. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share the great work that we're doing at the University of Alaska Fairbanks within our institute with regard to the development of not only agriculture but forestry research and how we're working at that circumpolar level. And so understanding the importance of the Arctic within this special committee, our focus today will be really looking at what we've done, where we're going, and why we're doing what we're doing. So we're really, really excited today. And I represent an amazing group of researchers, technicians, staff, and faculty that all work to enrich the lives of Alaskans every day. So today I'd like to share with you some of the work that we're doing for circumpolar connections and, in addition to that, strengthening our Alaska food system. We are a federally funded component of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We're part of the land-grant university system, and so we are obligated to share a notice of non-discrimination at all of our presentations. So after you've finished reading that, if you need it again, please let me know, and I'll share it later, but we'll move on. Thank you. As a quick reminder of what our institute is and where we're located and what we do, we are the Institute of Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Extension. We no longer have a School of Agriculture at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. However, our institute is a standalone institute where we do research and we do outreach. So our research side of the house is where we do our work for the National Land-Grant University program of the experiment station, the agriculture. And for us, we do agricultural and forestry research, and that's our experiment station. And then also within our institute, we also have the Cooperative Extension System, which is part of the land-grant programmatic side of the outreach component. And so our mission truly is to take research, use that research to develop education and outreach opportunities to enhance the lives of Alaskans. We do that in Alaska, very different than other states. We have our positive youth development, which is our 4-H program, and we also do community economic development work, forestry and environment work, agricultural research, and food security. Most of the work that we do can be placed into the realm of strengthening the Alaskan food system, regardless of which one of these piles that you would put that work. As you can see from this map, it's pretty self-explanatory. We, in addition to the two tractors, we also have agricultural research land in Delta Junction, where we have active research going on. And very exciting. It's to a point where we'll be hiring a summer technician who lives in Delta this summer. That's the first time that's happened in many, many years, well over 20. We have 10 cooperative extension service offices that are spread throughout the state. The exciting thing about our extension offices is that they are community folks who work in those offices. And so when we have an opportunity to share information with communities directly, we do that through these offices. So we have this network that connects us into those communities. And the work that we do is everything from food safety, food preservation, all the way through to the lumber grading program that has just started. So I'd like to start with a huge thank you. The governor's office very kindly was able to give us $2 million in funding to support our small grains and nutrition, livestock nutrition research work. And so I'd like to start first with some of the items that we purchased and why we did so. I think it's really important for all of you to understand that great needs were met with this money and that we used it very efficiently and in the most multifaceted way. These aren't, as a friend of mine calls it, these aren't garlic presses, right? Like, they're not a one-trick pony. These are multiple-use opportunities. And so I'd like to draw your attention to the two blue implements on the screen. You'll see that the one in the upper right is a planter. And that planter is from 1982. The parts are no longer available and haven't been for years. It breaks consistently. Our planting became very complicated because, as you well know, in Fairbanks, there's a very narrow window for planting. And if we're broken down and we miss the window, then that would alter our research for an entire growing season, and we have to wait until the next season. We were getting cross-contamination with this particular planter. And so that meaning if we had a particular grain being planted in one, we weren't able to clean it all the way out for the next plot to start. So we were having two different varieties in the same plot. So contamination. Not contamination that was bad, that it wasn't edible or it was poison or anything horrible. It's just contamination with a different variety. So it wasn't pure. So our planter was a problem. In the middle, the Dr. Seuss looking machine is our plot combine. And I want to explain the picture in the center, lower center, is also a combine. That's a more traditional looking combine. It's a multi-row combine. Our research plots are six wide. Okay, so you have six rows in a plot. If you can imagine using the combine in the bottom, you can't. It's not efficient. You'd have to plant six rows and then move 30 feet and plant six more rows. And you'll see in a slide later that we keep our plots very, very close together. So that combine is not going to work. So you need a specialized piece of equipment. Of course you do. And that is called a plot combine. And that's the picture in the upper middle. The plot combine, again, an 80s version, is very much it's very short, and it harvests six rows at a time. So you're able to harvest your plot, keep that harvested material separate to analyze it, and then do the next plot. Unfortunately, it's incredibly human-driven, and even sometimes literally. And so it takes three people to do a harvest, a plot harvest. As you see, they're all sitting and standing in and covering faces. There's lots of dust. There's a lot of particulate matter that's blown up in the process. And you have to have your technicians who are right ready with the bags to hook the new one up when a new plot comes through. Also, parts were not working, and again, our harvest window in Fairbanks is incredibly narrow, as it is in Palmer. And if we miss a harvest, we've missed our data collection, and we've missed a whole year of research. And it was breaking down a lot. So with this money, we were able to support getting rid of those two beasts. And now they're just weird, pretty things that sit at the farms, which is fine. We have two Zerns now. If you notice in the left-hand side, that is a new plot combine. And not only is this a really nice-looking combine, which really doesn't matter, but if you notice, there are two people inside. One of them is the driver, and they are driving to harvest a plot, six-row plot. The person next to them is a technician, and during this harvest, this machine and the technician are working with the machine so that material comes in, it's immediately labeled, and they keep going. There's no stop. There's no anything. The other thing that's fantastic is in this mechanism, the machine is also taking moisture content measurements, is taking weight measurements. It saved us just this fall time in harvest. It saved us 3.5 weeks of technician work in terms of data collection, of information that we just got from the machine itself. So not only is it a more efficient machine, it's helping us work more safely and faster. It's also helping us in terms of our team and getting them much we're getting our data much faster than before. The other really nice thing about the Zern is that the parts are John Deere compatible. And so all parts, if we need to replace a part, we can find it at a John Deere dealer. So Craig Taylor can order it for us, and we can have it at either of our farms at the same time. The other thing to keep in mind is that we have two farms that we're working at, and driving a piece of equipment between Palmer and Fairbanks during a three-day harvest window is not realistic. And so we were able to purchase one at each location, which is a fantastic opportunity. In the bottom right-hand corner, this is our new planter. This is a drill. This drill is also set up to – it's called a drill. I know it doesn't look like a drill, but it's called a drill. This planter is able to plant in plot size, so we can do the six-row width. It's very easy to move, and the really nice thing is that it can take seed sizes from the size of a pea, which is very large, all the way down to the size of canola, which is very small, and everything in between. And we can calibrate it much easier than the old one. And again, this is a John Deere, so the parts are available if anything happens. And we have one in both sites as well. So it's very exciting opportunities here. To continue bragging and thanking for the governor's funding, this is our support, some of the funds that we use to support our livestock nutrition research. We were able to purchase a new tractor and a new baler for round bales for our cattle, for our new livestock research program. That was a huge need. The tractor and baler we had, the baler broke down every time, and we were spending hours and days working on the baler, and then if there was a part, waiting until it got there 3 days later and really slowing down the haying process. So with this new one this year, we were able to hay in half the time that we've been in the last few years. So it's allowing our technicians to get the haying completed and then move on and do other things to support the research that happens at the farm. We were able to purchase lumber to fix up many of our exterior areas for the cattle. There's a little breeze in Palmer every now and then. And since the 1922, goodness sakes, well, probably that one too, but the 2022 windstorm that we had over the Christmas break and then the subsequent ones and this entire December, we had a lot of damage to these exterior paddocks and small areas for them. So we needed to fix those up before we were able to get any animals at all. So the middle one is kind of a an area for them to come in and stay warm. And the one on the upper right-hand side is where their water is going to be. We also welded a heater, a protector for the heater. That's the picture in the lower right. And so that way, we keep the water thawed in the wintertime, and the cows don't accidentally eat the heater cord, because they will. And then the really exciting thing that we're doing is the middle bottom picture and the middle left picture. The bottom left picture. This is called a Callan gate system. And this system is a feeding system for our livestock nutrition researcher. And he's going to be able to put a collar on a cow, and it has a microchip in it. That microchip it hits a sensor on the door of one of the Callan gates, and it opens only for that cow. And inside on the white side in the bins will be a food ration that's just designed for that one cow. And so that what that allows is now you can have 10 cows and really doing 10 different feeding trials simultaneously, knowing that Fred cow is not eating George cow's food and messing up your experiment. So Fred eats Fred's food. George eats George's food, everybody's happy, and the cows are able to have that focus, and they're eating only what's prescribed for them and only of the amount that they're allowed. They don't get to go and graze from everyone else's, literally. The exciting thing about this is this Callan gate system. If you see the picture in the bottom, this was taken just last week. Buried posts, and those metal posts are going to be the corners. We'll be building a shed around all of that. And we have a machine that we also spent with this money, and I'll show you later in the slides, that will be working inside that to deliver those food rations to the individual cattle. And it will all stay within that building. So we're building a building around the Callan gate system. And it was such a great opportunity that Fish and Game, who also have research on our facility in Palmer for their large wildlife ruminant nutrition program, they really liked the Callan gate idea. They bought one themselves. So our farm staff were able to install both, one for our research and then also for Fish and Game research as well. So they'll be doing the same thing, but it's not going to be cows. It'll be rain. It'll be caribou. So it's very exciting. Our forestry research and it's really important that we understand that we're doing forestry research because the circumpolar north holds the space for the boreal forest. And the boreal forest is the largest terrestrial ecosystem on Earth, full stop. Which is this is a very big deal for the need for research, because this is not a local research, but this is a circumpolar research, because the boreal forest is a circumpolar ecosystem. So the work that we're doing in Fairbanks can be applied across the circumpolar north with if we're not already partnering, we could be partnering with others. And so it's very exciting, the work that we're doing. So the picture in the top middle, this is one of our professors. This is Dr. Santosh Panda. Dr. Panda is a fantastic researcher who has lots of grant funding coming in. And he is really working on using satellite imagery ground truthing that imagery for Forrest and then amplifying that into a model. And then that model is showing healthy forest versus unhealthy forest. He's able to share that model then with BLM and our forestry folks in state so that as a fire begins to build, a fire will take a path of least resistance. And as it moves forward, it's going to more likely attack the unhealthy forest and move in that pathway versus the healthy forest. So what it's allowing is this model, just using satellite imagery, we don't need boots on the ground in the middle of somewhere else, but with that imagery, BLM is able to use this model to predict movement of fires and then be able to forewarn communities or prepare communities as it looks like it might be heading toward them. That's one application of the work that he's doing on healthy forests and using satellite imagery, because it is a huge space and we can't all have boots on the ground. The middle photo is a picture that's a moisture sensor. It is put into a tree, and then it's monitored, the moisture. Water cycling through the boreal forest is the largest movement of water in the circumpolar north. We think it's oceans, and it's not. It's actually the trees during transpiration. It's very exciting, the work that's being done by Dr. Jessie Young Robertson and her team and her lab, because what they're able to do is they're able to monitor, again, looking at forest health, but looking at it from a much broader perspective through drought. And she was able to do proof of concept of this 2 years ago when Denali National Park allowed her team to do some research plots in the preserve. You can see in the upper right-hand corner that is bark beetle damage there on a spruce. And what they started noticing is that bark beetle, like fire and any pest, is going to attack and really gather a lot of momentum in a sick tree, in an unhealthy tree. And what makes the tree most unhealthy in their research they've found is actually water. That's the number one indicator of health in a tree. What they were able to watch is a beetle bark infestation come up through almost the pinch point and see and predict it and where it would end based on tree moisture. And so it's a really great opportunity to see forest health tied to moisture and on a global perspective. The last photo is one of our researchers, Dr. Jan Daw. She works in the One Tree Program, which is a really huge applied research group that truly is the manifestation of the land-grant university. What they do there is through a birch tree, which is the one tree, they have K-12 curriculum developed on what happens to that tree throughout its life cycle, throughout a year, just an annual cycle, but then also its entire growth cycle, looking at it for product purposes, for economic development opportunities and all of that. So the work that they're doing right now with birch tapping is they're doing a terroir project, a flavor of place, much like wine. It tastes different in different places it grows. It's been shown that lots of things are like that, and we know that birch is similar. And so now to define that and see what it is. What had to happen before we could even start any of this birch syrup research is we had to come up with a vocabulary to talk about birch syrup flavor. So that has actually already happened. And now there is a tasting lexicon for birch syrup. And there is one for avocados and olive oil and wine and maple syrup and lots of different things. But now we also have a lexicon for birch syrup that started with us with this work, and that can go in a circumpolar way, of course, in different languages, but the same concept of the term. So the work is very important in a new and emerging industry as birch syrup becomes more and more popular in the state of Alaska as an entrepreneurial opportunity.
Director Anderson, before you leave this, speaking of forestry and the UAVs that you use to monitor the health of the forest, has any of that been shared with DNR related to their carbon sequestration project?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. That's excellent. Yes, and we have a new forestry faculty member who just came on, and one of the things that she worked on prior to her work with us, and I think this is a direction that her research will continue, is working with forestry and also with Yukon Flats area, wanting to designate for fire protection area for carbon sequestration. So protecting a forested area from fire and managing it that way, because that's valuable forest for carbon sequestration purposes. And yes, there is satellite imagery that's being used for that. Models being developed to run through the supercomputer to figure out all the magic that is beyond me at this point. But the really good news is that, yes, we are looking into the opportunities for carbon sequestration at a global level with the boreal forest in mind. Thank you for that question.
Thanks.
Our current agricultural research is very exciting. In the upper right-hand corner, you see that's a drone shot in Fairbanks of our plots. Those are grains. I know that's what those are. So we have barley, wheat, oats, and canola in those. And you can see how we plant those. They're very close together. We try to be as efficient as possible. This is great because it allows for a lot of opportunity to truly compare one variety to the other. They're as close together as possible so that they're in that same microclimate as much as we can. We now have a small grains breeder, as I mentioned last year, and that's part of the governor's funding that went to support that work. And so these are his plots that he's working on here. And I'll talk about a super exciting thing that he's doing now. But you can see next to it, this is an example of some of his work. We have in the middle, this is root maggot damage. Root maggot is a huge pest for us, and they really like vegetables that grow very well here in Alaska. And so this particular research project was a little snarky, I think, and it's kind of fun. One of our researchers, we work on cover cropping systems. Our soil scientist is working on cover cropping systems, and everybody sells all the virtues of cover crops. It's great. But our pest management folks said, wait a second, if you're growing radishes as a potential cover crop, or you're growing mustard as a potential cover crop, or whatever it is, are you actually attracting root maggots to your cover cropping system, which then would go into your horticulture system, yes, your cropping system? And so it wasn't snarky, but I think it's kind of funny because it's like, as you know, in Palmer, you look at these plots over here and they're gorgeous and they're cover crops and they're all different varieties of things and it's beautiful. And then you look over here and there's a bunch of cabbage and a few cover crops. And the whole goal was to see our cover crops really attracting good insects, right? The good ones, or are they... And are they attracting root maggots as well? And so we'll see the jury's still out at this point. We've only had one season of it, but it's actually great research because our growers need to know this. And that's the type of research we do. We do very practical, very pragmatic, very applied research, and we work directly with our producers around the state. Next to that is a really beautiful picture of some alfalfa. We have an alfalfa trial going on now that's happening with our soil scientist. We are wanting a good alfalfa. It's an excellent forage opportunity to cut as hay and feed to our livestock. It's also very good for the soil. In the lower 48, alfalfa is oftentimes grown as, almost as a perennial. You plant it, and then you can harvest it for many years after and cut multiple times a year. In Alaska, not so much. However, on our Fairbanks farm, we do have a plot that has that's 5 years old, which is really exciting. And there are sections of it that have been cut three times a year, and it still keeps coming back. So it's very exciting. Now we're trying, our soil scientist is collaborating with researchers in the lower 48 who are doing variety work on alfalfa, and they're helping us find a cold tolerant alfalfa that might be a better answer for us here in Alaska. Answering that question then directly feeds into livestock production and a more stable opportunity to feed that livestock. So terrestrial protein is something, livestock protein is something that's been lacking in our food system in Alaska. And in order to increase our livestock, we have to have food for them to eat. And so this alfalfa is a great opportunity for that. On the far left upper hand corner, it's very exciting. Yes, that is kelp. And why in the heck are you showing this, Jody? That's a great question. Thank you for asking. That is a variety trial. Just like in the upper right hand corner, that's a variety trial. And what's happening now that we have mariculture farms, we have kelp farms, they're in different environments. And is a sugar kelp right for that bay, or is a ribbon kelp better for that bay, or is a bull kelp better for that bay? And right now, nobody knows. So we're actually funding researchers who are doing variety trials. Light, salinity, and temperature are the three environmental conditions that they're doing in a lab setting, as you can see, like in this picture. But in order to advise our farmers, our kelp farmers, there has to be an opportunity to understand this. This is a collaboration with the College of Fisheries and Oceanic Sciences at UAF, and their researchers are doing this work. Not my nerds, but their nerds. And it's great because they are really coming up with some great answers that they didn't have answers to before. And there was no funding stream for variety trials. However, it's a crop, and so I did tweak it a little bit and sold it to USDA. We are the only mariculture project in USDA hatch work that's happening across the United States. So there. That's exciting. In the bottom left-hand corner is our beautiful greenhouse in pink LED. This is on the Trotheta campus at Arctic Health Building in Fairbanks. This is a combination of multiple studies of not only LED light, the correct end of the light spectrum that works the best for the biggest bang for your buck. Energy efficiency studies, which are huge here in Alaska, because if we are considering growing throughout the year, not only is heat critical, but light is critical, and energy is involved in both. So having a valuable, efficient lighting source that can also help the plants the best way is really critical. And they are just that pink. It's not weird. That's exactly what they look like. It's great to be in Fairbanks in the wintertime just once, and then that's it. But it's a beautiful color. And you can see we're also doing some hydroponic testing inside of our greenhouses. And the tomatoes, our researcher is holding. The shocking thing about these tomatoes is they taste like tomatoes. They don't taste like normal hydroponic vegetables. They are delicious, and they're year-round. And so once they're measured and evaluated in terms of data collection, then the really great part about the tomatoes that are from this research is that they're then donated to our culinary arts program, and then they're able to work with really fresh, delicious tasting vegetables in their programming as well. So it's a full circle concept. Our soil scientist, Dr. Kaylee Gash, the one on the right in the picture with the two women, she has taken it upon herself to do soil testing in areas of the state that haven't had agricultural soil testing in a very focused way. She's had over 1,000 different individuals reach out to her and offer their soil. She evaluates it and then moves it forward back to them for their own knowledge, but also for her into a database. She's looking at the soil web. So all of the living components of it, she's looking at the biology and also the chemistry within that soil. So it's a really exciting project that's giving us a better picture of workable soils across the state. Can kelp be used as an effective fertilizer in Alaska? This is our first year study, so we don't have any definitive data, but so far, so good. This is a collaboration project with Washington State University. Dr. Aaron Oliver is a Northwest climate scholar from Washington State. She doesn't work in Washington State. She's never met her colleagues at Washington State. She works with us in Palmer. The whole purpose of this program is to help us help facilitate more research, agricultural research in Alaska in areas that we just can't meet. So she decided to evaluate whether kelp waste can be used as a fertilizer. She's working directly with Prince William Sound. They gave her an intern, a student intern for the summer, and so they were able to get agricultural intern research opportunities all summer. And Erin grew carrots. That's all she grew. But she was very excited, and she was very pleased with the results so far. So stay tuned. We'll tell you what's up. The exciting news about that and how does that reach us at the Arctic level, at the circumpolar level, is that we are kind of the last ones at the table when it comes to kelp research and farming in that industry. So many of our circumpolar neighbors are already using these products. And so now we're establishing that can they be used in Alaska? And if so, what do we need to do with them beyond washing them, drying them? How do we apply them? Those simple questions are the ones that we're answering now.
Before you go on, Director Anderson, back to the soil. Do you ever work with, the Department of Natural Resources has soil that they occasionally will put up for agricultural land. Are you engaged in testing that soil so that the purchaser is informed about the qualities?
Through the chair, thank you for that. That was a very good question. And that isn't really our department. Fortunately, USDA's NRCS, Natural Resource NRC. Conservation Service, NRCS is responsible for soil testing across the United States. And so NRCS, and we have offices throughout the state of Alaska. And so they're the ones who do the true soil, the true soil analysis, and they do the write-up and they offer that analysis and it's available to the public. So it's out there, but we do not do that directly.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, thank you. On this research, how much of this research comes from the university deciding this is something we want to research? Or you mentioned USDA, Department of Agriculture, and that you needed some sort of an amendment to a grant proposal. Can you tell me how much is guided by federal requests?
Absolutely. Through the chair. Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. Yes, I don't have a statistic to give you, but I'll make one up on the spot. As all good true statistics are, I would say that well over 60% of our research is driven by our producers. And so it's our relationships with our producers where we're working together to solve problems as we move forward. Then I would say probably 30% of what's left is going to come from agencies with questions in state. And then maybe I would say very little of it is driven by a question that USDA has asked us. So that leaves 10% of who knows. But I would say that 10% falls into the areas of expertise of our researchers. And based on their areas of expertise and kind of anticipating questions that producers may have. And then that research becomes the opportunity to then engage with producers and then get a more informed research question.
Okay. And follow up?
Yes, follow up, Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, and so, you know, the new food pyramid, there's a new food pyramid that came out recently, and I still don't understand what it means. But one of the things, besides the big Costco turkey in the front, it has, like, green beans in a can. Does that – so now there's, like, a new – see, that hasn't been changed in 30 years or something like that. So this is a new set of – potential changes coming to what producers want to produce, what I imagine what stores can buy, what, you know, it guides a lot. So has that changed any research at this point, or do you think it will in the future?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. And no, to be very honest, it's so new. We are not agile enough with our funding to be able to respond to something that came out a couple of months ago. So at this point, no. I believe that until our state begins to invest more in buying – our state institutions invest in buying more local foods – I don't think that that's ever going to fall back on us to change what we're doing to meet the needs of that upside-down triangle. Once the state, positively stated, once the state does start purchasing local grown products and we start increasing our production of these for the purchase by the state, I think that that very well could drive a direction. But many of the things that we're producing are already on that pyramid in the right way, in the right quantity. It's just the processing of it that I think is the more key focus. And that isn't up to our researchers' side of things. That's much more of the post-harvest production and the post-harvest industry.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we are members of the Circumpolar Ag Association, and this past year we participated in the 12th Circumpolar Agriculture Conference in Tromsø, Norway in September. And I want to make a special thanks to our chair, Senator Giesel, for your attendance. I really do appreciate the time and the energy that you put into learning more about circumpolar agriculture. As you can see, we had a great group of participants, and I will also brag that Alaska brought a lot of folks, and we made some of the other closer countries feel weird because there were so many Alaskans. And so that made me very happy because I'm all about making people feel weird. Not only did we participate, but we also presented. We had multiple presentations, and we were able to really, really collaborate and talk with researchers who are doing so many similar things. They just happen to be in a different language many times. The great opportunities to participate with this group is it makes so much sense because we have so much in common. Our light issues are similar. Our temperature issues are similar. Our pest issues are similar. The varieties of food that we can successfully grow are almost exactly identical. And so I feel that it's very important that we learn how others are successful so that we can maybe incorporate some of those ideas into the work we're doing, but also, be better stewards of the work that we are doing. And so this work is very applicable, to the work that is being done now in both our livestock and small grains research. In our livestock research, you'll see that there is a kelp harvester in the middle upper picture. That kelp harvester, regardless of the type of kelp that's being grown, there is waste involved in the kelp harvest. The ribbon will be cut and then graded, but beyond the cut, there's still anywhere almost up to a whole foot. They try to be more efficient, but of the ribbon itself plus the holdfast. So there's almost a stem, but it's not called a stem because it's algae. But it's very interesting because that string, because they have it out on string, that string is used again, but it has to get stripped. And that's all waste product. So instead of just chucking it back in the ocean or throwing it, unfortunately, into a landfill where we don't have enough space anyway, what we're doing is trying to figure out ways to use that waste. And our livestock researcher, Dr. Jim Vineyard, is working on just that question. He is taking dry kelp product, which you see in the bottom left-hand corner. He's grinding it to a fine powder, which you see in the upper right-hand or left corner. And that material is what will be rationed out to the cows. The idea is that growing in the ocean, it picks up a tremendous amount of micronutrients. And those micronutrients are the same micronutrients that our livestock producers have to buy in a very heavy block form. If we can figure out a small industry in Alaska using a waste product and is beneficial to our cattle and other livestock, then we're going to use it and share that opportunity with our circumpolar friends. So this work that Jim is doing is starting with beef cattle and looking at, true nutrition science. He's going to figure out the right recipe. When do the beef cattle need this material the most? How often do they get it? All of those types of things. And then he's also going to start working with sheep and goats because small livestock is very popular in Alaska and across the circumpolar north, of course, but also then looking at poultry potentially. And so not only is it going to be waste from the mariculture and the kelp farming industry, but also there will be from the harvesting of all of our seafood and that waste as well. So he has a great relationship with our cattle producers. We're getting cows donated So it saves us a tremendous amount of money. Also, we're getting a lot of the kelp donated as well. In fact, just last week, Blue Evolution just donated what will be dried down to approximately 400 pounds of both ribbon kelp and sugar kelp. So not only looking at just kelp as a whole, but looking at the individual varieties of kelp and what they offer in terms of nutrition.
Director Anderson, is salt an issue? I mean, this stuff grows in the ocean. Does it absorb a lot of salt? And how do the animals, I mean, humans have to be careful, right? How about animals? High blood pressure?
Through the chair. Thank you. Yes, and it's more of an iodine issue. Iodine is a much bigger concern. Because iodine is a micronutrient, it has a very narrow range of happiness in a body. Anything below that line, it is deficient. Anything above that magical, very small window is toxicity. And so, in fact, this material, if fed too much to cattle, can create a iodine toxicity. It's a concern, especially in beef cattle, because that iodine goes into muscle structure, which is what we eat when we eat beef. So that toxicity can actually be passed to humans. So it is important that we do this work and understand the right ratios and recipes, because we don't want to tell farmers, sure, if you get kelp, just give it to your cows. Mm-hmm. Because at a certain point, they can actually become toxic. But salt, not so much of an issue. The material we get has also been washed.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. On the right side is our small grains work. And the work that Dr. Hassan is doing is fantastic. These are two wheat seeds you'll see in these petri dishes. Ingall is wheat that is kind of the gold standard in Alaska. And then in the left petri dish, you see very plump, large, beefy looking seeds. Those wheat seeds are the result of the breeding program that we're working on in Fairbanks. And please nerd out with me for a brief moment, because we're going to go back to high school science class. And this is a really important thing that's happening. Dr. Hassan has built a doubled haploid genetic lab. This genetic lab takes pollen grains from the anther, manipulates the pollen grain that has half of the genetic material, kind of freaks out the pollen. It doubles its genetic material. It makes an identical copy of itself. And now it thinks it's a full plant. It has a full chromosome number. And then you end up making identical homozygous, meaning they're exactly the same genetically. There's no weirdos all the way out from that point forward. So this double haploid is happening for all of your major grains across the United States and across the world. This research is happening. The reason it's a really big deal that we have this lab at the UAF campus and that it is a public lab. Private industry is where these labs are found. So your seed companies are doing this work exactly like we're doing, but for a much larger audience, and it's a much larger financial gain for them. There will be, emphatically, no private industry that would want to invest the time and energy it takes to do genetic testing through this opportunity for cold soils. So the fact that we are a public institute in the circumpolar north who are able to do breeding this way is huge, because we're looking for characteristics that are supported in the circumpolar north. We're looking for characteristics of short growing season, cold soil and cold tolerant, and also early maturing. Those are things that no one cares about in the private industry. Those are characteristics that get kicked out of breeding programs. So for us to have this is a huge step, not just for Alaska, but for the whole entire circumpolar north. We'll also be able to rent space out and our expertise, which is going to be good once everything kicks in. And the reason that double haploid genetic testing and these labs are such a big deal is that the way that traditionally genetic work was done is it takes from the very beginning to release of a grain, a new variety, could go anywhere between 15 and 20 years, the timeline. What's happening now is modern technology, not doubled haploid, but just using technology, and our researcher is doing grow outs in our wintertime in New Zealand during their summertime. So he's got two growing seasons that he's doing everything. So he's kind of shrunken everything down to about, he anticipates about a 6 to 8 year release, which is really exciting because our farmers want this. You saw the difference in those two grains in the previous picture. That's what we're getting ready to do. Higher productivity, bigger bang for the buck for our producers. With this doubled haploid, you've cut out 3 years from the process. So now we're looking at starting and ending easily within a 5-year time period. And that is huge, because we are going to be able to be more resilient and more flexible and more able to respond to the needs of our growers faster. And so he is working on this with barley and wheat. And also both of those are very – there's very little work being done in doubled haploid world in barley and wheat. So some of the things may also have some intellectual property opportunities. Sorry, I went down a hole. It makes me really excited. At the Circumpolar Ag Conference, we were able to visit one of their experiment stations in Tromsø, which is that horrible location there next to the water with the barn. Some of our folks that went with us, I wasn't sure if I really should have a picture of Senator or not, but I chose not to. But she was there, and she's in lots of my pictures. But one of the things that was very exciting for us was the Raspberry House. That was in late September, and all those raspberries were there. And it was all done up off the ground and espaliered, so spread out kind of like wine vines or grape vines are for wine. So picking is very easy. You didn't bend over. You didn't do anything. And they do a lot of research with regard to berries there at that particular station. It was a really, really great experience. And during that experience, I opened my mouth, as I do, and I volunteered us to be the hosts of the next Circumpolar Ag Conference. So please put it in your calendars. We will have this the 29th through 31st of August in 2028. We'll be hosting this at the Fairbanks campus. We did host this years ago, I believe it was in 2015, and they had it in Girdwood. And I said, nope, we're going to have it in Fairbanks. So it will be in Fairbanks. And instead of just getting ready for it, as we do, I decided that we would launch a ramp up, if you will, to the conference itself, using the conference as an opportunity for the entire campus, for all of the university, for our land grant University of Alaska, to really get excited and know that these are folks coming to us from the Circumpolar North, and there's a lot of food system adjacent work happening across campus. But because we're in our little silos and in our little colleges and research areas, we don't know that. And so it's huge we're doing a speaker series, and we're doing it for the next 3 years. We started it this year. We kicked it off. We have one a month. And I say that, and then if you look, you'll say, Jody, there's two in March. Yes, there are also two in April. But we're catching up. We have really good things. The whole purpose, this is not, I told my researchers, this is not you standing up talking about your research. This is you talking about your research in a global concept and giving us an opportunity to ask questions and talk about ideas. It's an idea sharing opportunity. And so we have it at noon. It's available on Zoom. And we have been averaging 70 people per session that attend. We have a lot more that also collect or that we send the recording to. And we've had participants from Norway, Iceland, the Faroe Islands. Many participants from Canada also are listening and participating in the conversation. We had one just this Tuesday, and it was just absolutely fantastic. And so I wanted to share with you that not only are we having these talks, we're also talking about, as you see, Jan Daw, that's our One Tree person, our birch syrup person. We're also have one of our forestry ecology researchers who's presenting. And then the very last one feeds into next year's theme. So this year has all been folks from our shop talking about what our institute does and how it frames this work. The very last one I'm very excited about because Melissa Good, Dr. Good, is with the Sea Grant program and MAPS program in Kodiak. And she reached out and said, can I please present? And I said, how about you present with Jim because you guys are already working together. So now all of next year, each of the speaker opportunities will be not people from our institute, but people who are adjacent to the work across campus doing these same conversations. And then our third year, getting us ready for 2028, that academic year, we will have our producers being part of the conversation. They're already participating in these as observers, but we're wanting them to also be those presenting to really get people talking and continue to talk about what food systems look like in the circumpolar north and how can we better work on that question as a whole campus that will not only respond to the needs of Alaskans, but also our circumpolar friends. That has triggered work that I am beginning to do. And fortunately, we have an interim chancellor who is very active in the Arctic world. As you know, interim chancellor Sfrega was the former ambassador to the Arctic. And this is work that I have started because of our work with the Circumpolar Ag Conference. The Circumpolar Ag Association has wanted to be involved in more policy conversations. We're not at the tables in Reykjavik for the annual meetings at that policy level. And how can we not be talking about food? And because this is a direction that we're wanting to go in, I'm starting to work more in that world, using the work that we're doing at the Institute and connecting us into these Arctic policy conversations. So on the right, you'll see these four happy people in the rain in Palmer at our farm. This was right after Arctic Encounter last year, this last fall. And these are current ambassadors to the Arctic. So we have Finland, Sweden, and Greenland all represented in that photo. And I met them and dragged them out to, and convinced them to come to the farm. The gentleman handing me his phone is Dr. Kenneth Goh. He is an agronomist from Greenland. He is also kind of the main worker for the Arctic Council, and because the Kingdom of Denmark holds leadership there for the next 2 years, Kenneth is kind of the worker bee of that, and having an agronomist in that position and doing the work that I'm trying to do, our institute is doing, and recognizing where Alaska sits in this, and having Chancellor Sraga involved, we have the greatest opportunity that we'll have in several years to get in, to get our feet in the door, and have Arctic agriculture as part of the agriculture conversation at the Arctic policy meetings. So I will be working on holding a joint panel with you, Arctic President Lars, and myself at the Arctic Encounter Summit this April. And so I know there'll be lots of our friends from the Circumpolar North there who attend. And so starting the conversation about increasing the policy opportunities with regard to agriculture is really exciting work that is kind of my future work. And so the reality is our funding request this year for our institute, we were asked, the university was asked to add in our $3 million request that was last year's request. And so OMB asked where the food security ask was. So the Board of Regents added it. It was accepted. So we are in the Red Book on page 11. We are asking for a $3 million operating budget increase, and it was approved by the Board of Regents, and it was not included in the governor's budget. So the work that we are doing across the state, and the work that we're our products across the state that are then getting incorporated into our circumpolar conversations can only improve and increase if we have more researchers answering these questions. This week has been fascinating meeting with many of you and all of the other legislators we've been able to speak with. And there are a long list of things people want us to do. And I appreciate it, and I can't do it if I don't have the funding that can hire those experts. So right now we have a livestock nutritionist, which is really exciting. And the work he's doing is tremendous and has, you know, the opportunity to reach beyond our borders. But unfortunately, I only have one. So that is our operating budget. And please understand and respectfully, this is a tough year, and I'm very aware of that. But I do want to let you know that we do valuable work, and that we are a really good bang for the buck, and this is where our ask sits.
Director Anderson, before you go on this page, you have a green crab. I want you to talk about why the green crab is there.
Well,
first of all, it's an invasive species.
Thank you. Through the chair, I appreciate your observation of the ugly green crab. The green crab is invasive. It is coming up the coast. It is in Alaska. It isn't far into Alaska, but it is here. And it is a very serious concern on our coastlines. And so with any invasive species, we want to be on this as quickly as possible. And we have folks within our institute who are pest specialists, invasive pest specialists. And so they are working with Fish and Game. Right now it's more of a monitoring and see where we are with it and ideas of what can be done. But because we have so much more warm water coming up the coastline and the ocean pH is just right for these guys to come in without much problem, and they're really taking over. So in areas where they have become an infestation, they're a huge problem, and we want to be proactive and not reactive to the situation. So we're working on that. We only have one person, but they're definitely that's part of some of the things that they're working on.
You mentioned that there was some question about it being a food source.
Through the chair, they're not human edible. So, I mean, we don't have to be hungry enough to eat them, I think, is what the answer is. Everything's edible. And these definitely don't really have a predator that likes them either. So in the disposal opportunities, that too could be put into the meal, if you will, that could be fed to livestock. So we're looking at that as a kind of a full circle opportunity. But more importantly than the feed concept, it's just handling this before it gets out of control and wreaks havoc with our very important mariculture industry.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your time and allowing me to share some of the amazing work that my folks are doing. And on behalf of the Institute, thank you so much. And please know that I'm available. And if you have questions, to email me, and I'll get back to you as quickly as possible and let you know what we can do. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for being here.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
All right. So that concludes our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be next Thursday. That's February 19th. And we're going to hear a presentation from Alaska Shadu Network. This is a company that tracks our marine vessels with some amazing technology, identifying the vessel, who owns it, what cargo is on it, all along our coast. And so they will be here presenting. And so at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 2:43 p.m.